So this morning, I want to take a little bit of a diversion. As I have been doing this series that I've been doing on rescuing popular and favorite biblical verses from their present-day meaning and application, and as it's led me in my thinking and considering where we are as a church and where I am as a person and as a pastor, I think I've been led to share the following with you because I want to go back to a certain sense to my rootedness as a Christian and as a pastor. And so all of us have these defining moments in our lives, I think. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good. They make us who we are. We make choices, and based on those choices make us. And sometimes we follow those things to some wonderful conclusions about our life, and other times we don't. Sometimes we get diverted from those wonderful things that we've decided to do because of those defining moments in our life. Perhaps you had someone in your life who spoke to you at a powerful time and a really meaningful time in your life when you needed somebody to speak. They came into your life, they came alongside you, and they shaped you in a way that you will be forever thankful for. I'm going to take that tack right now, I think. And so as I unpack this, I want you to hear my heart. And I want you to hear it in terms of how it impacts us as a church community. So when I went to Geneva College as a freshman, I recall the administrators there. Now, you know that Geneva College is a Christian school, and they take that part of who they are very seriously. And I remember Don Sullivan and Dean Cunningham and any number of administrators saying about that particular class in 1979. Actually, I graduated in 79. Yep, so I ended up there in the fall of 1979. And I remember them saying very clearly about that particular class, how they were impressed, moved, inspired by a number of the freshmen who came in who demonstrated significant leadership ability, great character, men and women that gave them real hope about educating them and people like them. And they really made a point of it. And we heard that throughout the course of the year. Now, to be clear, I would not say that I was one of those people. But I'm going to describe to you a couple of those people whom I know they were talking about. And so over the course of those 4 years, there were a number of people who distinguished themselves, and it was easy to see. They really were people of great character. They really were people who influenced other students in powerful ways. One of them was a guy named Eddie Hartman, who was an All-American option quarterback out of Butler High School. And Eddie looked like he was a four-lettered athlete out of Butler. He was being recruited by schools like Alabama, Nebraska, major Division I schools who wanted his unique ability and talent as an option quarterback. So as the entire community of Butler waited with bated breath about who he was going to sign with, he announced Geneva College. I mean, it was this huge letdown in the community because they believed that he was throwing his life away, that he had the world at his fingertips as an All-American option quarterback at any one of those major schools. So Eddie came to Geneva, and he roomed with five other guys. One of them was a center named Calvin Traup, who has since gone on and was a professor at Duquesne University for years, and he is now the president of Geneva College. Another guy named Keith Myers, who was also out of Butler, was a youth ministry major at Geneva College. Another guy named Andy Bernard, who was, I think, from Peters Township. He was the second string quarterback who roomed with the first string quarterback all 4 years at Geneva College. Now, anybody who knows anything about competition knows that that would be an exceedingly rare thing. But they were best friends, and they loved each other as brothers. So there were a couple other guys who were in that room, and they lived in that room for all 4 years. And as a room made a huge difference on that campus. So Eddie also, in ninth grade, started dating a girl named Mary Beth. And Mary Beth looked like the All-American girl. I mean, like the first-string quarterback, the All-American girl. I mean, it was like a storybook kind of thing. She did not go to Geneva College. But they continued to date 4 years in high school and then 4 years in college and loved each other very much. And so I'll go to say to you that, I'll go ahead and say, because I think he would be fine with me saying this. So I remember talking with him in the springtime, a month or so before we were graduating, and we were talking about his marriage, and he said how much he was looking forward to that. And he said, you know, that he and Mary Beth had worked very hard on their relationship and that they had remained morally pure all 8 years. That they wanted to honor God in that kind of a way. So he said many other things, but that struck me. I've taught youth ministry for a lot of years, and I'm telling you, when somebody says they've been dating 8 years, you think, that's pretty tough. I'm just saying what the empirical evidence has said to me. So we graduated. It was a wonderful graduation. And about a week later, they were scheduled to get married. And so they were having their wedding at Memorial Park Presbyterian Church in Pittsburgh. And after the rehearsal, dinner, all six of them congregated around outside the church, and they looked at Mary Beth and said, we're going to go for a ride because we'll never be this way together again. And so they got in the car, and they took off, joking, laughing, recounting old times, great memories, joking with Eddie about getting married, all those kinds of things. And as they went up Route 28 north of Pittsburgh and were exiting that ramp, down the ramp was coming a career alcoholic and his wife, and who got into a terrible argument and in a fit of rage turned down the off-ramp at a high rate of speed to run into whatever car was coming up the off-ramp in order to kill themselves. And they hit the car containing all of those guys, pulverizing it. It took rescuers the entire night to get the bodies out of that car and to identify who they were. And the man and his wife walked away. What was remarkable about that was, I remember watching the evening news, and one of the reporters went to the home of Keith Myers, who was killed in the accident, and they wanted to know what the parents' response was, right? And as he spoke out the door, the man said, look, this has been a terrible tragedy for my family and me. But we also know that Jesus Christ loves that man. And we are hopeful that through this tragedy, that somehow he might straighten out his life and come to faith in Christ. Mary Beth was getting ready to go to the church when the doorbell rang to tell her that Eddie had been killed in that accident, in that car crash. So I was home in Washington, PA, in the basement of my house, when the phone rang. And Sally Cheney, who was the dean of women, called. And she said to me, she said, "Rich, a terrible thing has happened." And she recounted to me about the story regarding Eddie and Keith and the rest of the men. The rest of the men were severely injured. It took them months to recover. And so as I hung up the phone with Sally Cheney, I recall there were three very clear things that went through my head. The first of which was just the sense of loss. I mean, you know, we were not best friends, but I was a friend of his and I was an admirer of his and Keith. And the sense of loss. I mean, if you have any sense of the potential of a thing and then the loss of that potential and the good that it could do and the tragedy that's associated with that, that's what went through my head. And then the third thing that you could feel, because we were such a tight community at the school at the time, you honestly, it was almost like audibly you could hear this hue and cry of people who were broken because of this great loss. I mean, it reminded me really of some of the accounts in the Old Testament where when something happened and all of Israel cried, you got that sense it was just like that. And then the third thing that went through my mind was, how do you replace the loss of an Eddie Hartman and a Keith Myers? I mean, this was such a significant story that it made USA Today. It made People Magazine. And as I was down there thinking that through and praying about that, I was thinking, Lord, I'm no Eddie Hartman and I'm no Keith Myers, but what I am, you have made me. So I'm going to devote the rest of my life to finding ways to replace the Eddie Hartmans and Keith Myerses of the world. And you know what? That's what I did, largely. So when I was a youth minister and when I was a college professor, I could say that I worked pretty tirelessly at that very thing. I have a Bible in my office, in the back of which are a bunch of names of young men and women who came to faith in Christ. And many of them, if they are not involved in church leadership, they are involved in leadership in a variety of ways in their lives as men and women of character and honor and faith. So I came to Conway Alliance Church after I left Geneva College. And that burden was still on my heart, but a church is different. It's a different kind of community. People don't give you quite the same kind of access in their lives like they do when they're young men and women. They live their lives a little more like this. They have a lot of stuff going on. They have families, they have kids, they have jobs. They struggle with the priorities in their lives, like exactly how much do I do? Do I give? Do I participate in the things in life of faith versus all these? So sometimes their lives are a little bifurcated. They're a little, you know, they have work and they have their family and they have their church. I don't know. It's all very different. So because it's muted in that kind of a way, it made it a little more challenging for me to focus on that here. But I want to tell you, and I want to say, I think there's a sense in which I've walked away or have been diverted away from this thing. This thing where I need to be the kind of pastor that is investing in people's lives so that they become more than what they are, and as they develop the image of Christ in them, they would do the things that Jesus would do if he were they in the here and now, and they would be the kind of people who would replace the Eddie Hartmans and Keith Myerses of the world. Many of you know that that I spend a lot of time critiquing the culture, reading about it, studying. And I think that if there was ever a time where men and women needed to be men and women of God who would take up the mantle of leadership and try to influence the world in which they live, that's today. I mean, in just a few short years, from the 1980s, when almost universally within the culture, we would have declared ourselves a Judeo-Christian culture, a worldview that was Judeo-Christian, we would have, almost all of us have agreed to that. And then after the 1980s and early 1990s, we entered into a period of what I would call détente, where the world said to Christians, well, you do your thing. And the Christians said to the world, well, you do your thing, but we're just going to kind of live in an uneasy truce with each other. And then in about 2005, 2008, it changed entirely. Because then the culture began to say to the church, you can't think that way. You can't value those things. You can't act in that manner. You can't believe that because it's wrong. And ever since then, the church has been back on its heels, culturally speaking. And for those churches who have not been back on their heels, they have become more and more increasing like the culture itself. Now, you know that I don't talk about this very much, but I'll use it by way of an example. I have an ongoing conversation with a woman who has been a Christian almost in her entire life, devout in her faith, practicing, compassionate, but she will stand there and go toe-to-toe with me that she can support a person who supports the annihilation of a late-term baby or a baby that's just been born. If you ask me, that's a person who's become a little too much like the culture. So lately, I've been meeting with other pastors who are in the Pittsburgh area, asking them how they do ministry, what's going on in their churches, because I'm fascinated by what is going on in our culture. They said things like this: we are trying to come to terms with how it used to be that a person would say they know that they are active in their church because they attend 3 to 4 times a month. And today they said, and this is almost every church, they look at us and say, we are active in your church even though we come 1 to 2 times a month. Now, there are, I want to say, I think this is true, 5,840 waking hours in a year. Somebody, you want to check me on that, but it's significant. 5,840 waking hours in a year, times 16. Let's say you sleep 8 hours. If you go to church half of the 52 weeks of the year, and you are awake for that long, and you are being influenced, in some ways maybe good, but in other ways maybe not so good, help me to understand how 26 hours a year in church is going to help to shape our minds and our hearts in a way that we live Christianly. And not just that we survive Christianly, but that we live these vital, powerful, victorious lives where it's compelling when people see us in terms of how we've been shaped by the Word of God and by the beauty of the community in which we live. The same is true of our kids. Now, Jordan is away. He took about 4 or 5 kids to camp. And he has worked hard and diligently on those kids. 2 of them came to faith 2 nights ago because of the work that he's done. And now his work really is set before him because now he has to disciple them. And he has to counter so much of what is pulling those kids away. So if you want, and I'm going to jump. So then here's what I wanted to go to first. So in Ezekiel 22 verse 30, this was the text that group of leaders at Geneva rallied around. This was the text that I got swept up into. This was the text that they all wanted to be able to say that this was a part of their life. And so this comes from the prophet Ezekiel in the Old Testament, who lived around the 6th century B.C., who was the prophet, one of the primary prophets, when all of Israel was carried off into captivity by the Assyrians. So remember, Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, Romans, Greeks, and then Romans. Those were the 5 people groups that subjected Israel. The Assyrians were the first ones. And the Assyrians came because of Israel's disobedience, because of Israel's idolatry, because Israel collapsed in their faith. Because there were a lot of people in Israel who thought they only had to do a certain thing to get by. And if that's all they had to do, they were safe. But they were not safe. Because what happened to them was they eventually bought into all of the other crazy religious faiths that surrounded them. Not the least of which was the religion of Molech, which was all about offering infant children and sacrificing them in the fire. So the Assyrians were sent to punish Israel. And God spoke to Ezekiel in Ezekiel 30, verse 22, and this is what he said. He said, "And I searched for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it. But I found no one." And Eddie Hartman and Keith Myers and Calvin Trapp all loved this verse because they were determined that they were going to be one of those people who stood in the gap. And as long as they were alive, God would never be able to say, "I found no one." And then with Eddie's passing and Keith's passing, it became clear to me that this needed to be my verse as well. And so it has been. But as I said before, I think that I have been distracted away from it. And so I want you to know that this is going to be the foundation of what I do from here on. And if you like that idea, then partner with me on it. If you think that idea is a good idea, then let's do some great things together. If you don't like that idea, then this might not be the place for you. Because I'm going to be undeterred. I'm 59. And I have maybe 15 or 20 good years left where I'm going to try and take the sum total of everything that I've learned in terms of my knowledge, my experience, my education, all of those things, and I'm going to try and coalesce it and make something happen. And I'm saying to you that this, and you've heard me say this before years ago, this little church on this big hill can do great things and this little town. We can do that. So, there's another passage I want us to look at. And this is from the book of Matthew. If you want to turn to it, you may. This is Matthew 25. And all of you are familiar with this text, I'm sure. So Matthew 25, verses 14 through 30. So Jesus recounts this parable to those around him, beginning with verse 14. And he says, "For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to the other 2, to another 1, each according to his ability." God gives everyone here opportunity to use their talents, each according to your ability. He then went away. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the 2 talents, he made 2 talents more. So what they did was they took with what God had given to them, it wasn't theirs, and they invested, they worked, they became stewards of it, and they made a difference, and they had a good return. Let me ask you this question. If you can invest in something and know that you can double your return, would you do it? Any numbers, people here? When does that ever happen? It never happens. So these men doubled the return that was given to them. Verse 18, but he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now, after a long time, he could have gone back, right? He could have had second thoughts. He could have thought, well, that isn't such a good idea. I should probably do something with that money. But that's not what he did. After a long time, the master of those servants came back and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, "Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here, I have made 5 talents more." And the master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much." So he was rewarded. There was merit for his effort. And that's what he was given. "I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." You ever have a boss you could not please? No matter what you did, no matter how hard you worked, no matter what the return you gave, he still could not be pleased. But then did you ever have a boss that you worked and you worked diligently? And then they said, "Wow, this is incredible. Thank you. Thank you for your effort." And you're thrilled. You love it when your boss is happy with your work. Verse 22. And he also who had the 2 talents came forward saying, "Master, you delivered to me 2 talents here. I have made 2 talents more." His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." You all convinced here? When we settle accounts with God, that we will enter into the joy because of how we did what we did and the return that we gave. Verse 27. Verse 24. I don't have my glasses on. Verse 25. 24, thank you. So he who also had received the one talent came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you do not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. In other words, you have high expectations for me, for anyone. You have very high expectations. So I was afraid and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what is yours. In other words, I just did what I had to do. I took the maintenance program. I patronized you because I figured if I didn't lose it, then you wouldn't be upset with me. I wasn't willing to take the risk. I just want to tell you, there are too many Christians, too many of us, too many churches that are on a maintenance program. We are only doing what we have to do. We only do what we have to do so that we are convinced enough that we've done enough that we still get to keep what we think we have. Verse 25, so I was afraid and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours. But the master answered him, you wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with bankers, and at my coming I would have received what was mine with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For everyone who has more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness, and in that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So let me ask you this question. Is what we are doing with our life now as a Christian, in light of the world in which we live, is it a faithful return to the Master? Is what we are doing now, is what we have done as a Christian, in light of the world in which we live, a faithful return to the Master? I think it's a good diagnostic question. And I'm asking that question because I want to tell you that the world in which we live is going to require the kind of Christian who is more mature, who is more put together, who is more resolved, who is more determined, who is more insightful, who is more wise, who is more Christ-like than this nation has ever needed before. And if any of us think that we can survive what I believe to be the coming storm based on a life where we're just holding on to that one talent, we have fooled ourselves. More will be required of us. Much more will be required of us. So, and that's really what Paul says in Timothy, right? In the last days, these things will happen. Was there anything in the call to worship that you could not relate to? So look, if Ezekiel 22 verse 30 is my vision, and I continue to be called to Conway Alliance Church, then by default, it's your vision too. If you don't like my vision, then ask me to leave. If you don't like this vision, then maybe you should be someplace else. I'm not saying that in a mean sort of way. I'm just saying that we all have to come to terms with where we are and what we're doing together. Because it's going to be almost impossible for me to sustain this thing by myself. Amen. We have to do it together. And we have to be on the same page. Because I'm telling you, that world out there really needs it. So, I just want to break a few things down for you real quick so that you understand what I'm saying. Look, I think that we live in a culture in crisis, that every kind of upside-down cultural thing is trying to be mainstreamed. I said 6 or 7 years ago that they would mainstream fadophilia and pedophilia, and I had audible gasps come from this congregation, and I heard people say, no, that will never happen. And I am telling you right now, in the higher education and in the medical field, they are doing exactly that. They are mainstreaming pedophilia and fadophilia, saying that those people are not ill, that's just how they're born. There are a whole bunch of examples I could give you. I'm just giving you that one example. And so what I want to say to you is that we have to be that kind of church that lives lovingly, lovingly and obediently in response to those kinds of things where everything is upside down. I mean, in the book of Isaiah, it says, woe to those who say this: what is bad is good and what is good is bad. Look, I just want to say, when I was 18, I believed pretty much what I believe now. I valued then pretty much what I value now. My worldview was pretty much the same as it is now. And I was regarded as a young man that would have been virtuous back then. And now in many sectors of the culture, I would be called an extremist, a hater. The world is turned upside down. And it needs people like you and me to model Christ. I'm not going to get involved in all these dumb political battles and things like that, because I don't think that's where we change things ultimately. I think we change things. I'm not saying that we don't have things to say about it. I'm just saying I'm not hanging my hat on that. I'm going to hang my hat on Christ. I'm going to hang my hat on the example that he needs to be in all of us. That's where it needs to be. So, what does it mean for us as a church to stand in the gap? We need to stand in the gap as a church for what we do well. We are a small church. We have limited resources. There are only a few things that we can do well. What, years ago, when I worked at Christ Church at Grove Farm, when John Guest was there, I think we counted between 35 and 40 different substantial ministries that they did on a weekly basis. That's not what we have. So we'll do this. We will stand in the gap as an enclave of orthodox biblical preaching and teaching. I will promise you that I will always remain true and faithful to the orthodox, right teaching, biblical message. I will not let that go. I will confront it when it needs to be confronted. I will teach it faithfully. And anybody who teaches here, I will be the gatekeeper to make sure that they do the same thing as well. That is not where many of our churches are today. And I will not be one of those. So I promise you that will be the case. We will stand in the gap when it comes to right teaching. We will stand in the gap when it comes to being an enclave of authentic Christian community. We will fight the pettiness that sometimes sneaks itself into every Christian community. We will keep the main thing the main thing. We will love each other as Christ loves each other. And if we have conflict, we will lovingly address that. If you have conflict with me, you need to lovingly address me. Not take a bunch of phone calls with me or anybody else. The enemy's first line of attack is always to divide and conquer. Always. And you know why he doesn't need that many more? Because we're pretty susceptible to just that alone. It's pretty much a one-stringed banjo that's in terms of what he needs for most churches. We're going to stand in the gap when it comes to the biblical approach to missions. We're going to use the biblical metaphor, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and uttermost places. We're going to do ministry here as missions. We're going to do ministry in our region. We're going to do ministry in the greater Western Pennsylvania, tri-state area, and we're going to do international missions. We can't do all that all the time, but we can do all that some of the time, consistently. And we will. We will do what we can. We will not do what we can't. So that's what we need to do when it comes to standing in the gap for missions. We're going to stand in the gap when it comes to children's ministry. We have a wonderfully gifted person who does children's ministry. Holly Beatty Kiefer not only is gifted, she's passionate. And if you have children, she needs to see your children. If you have children, they need to be in Christian community with those kids, growing up in that Christian community. We're going to do that with our Children's Church program, which is why you're important as we help do that in the back. Because remember, if they're only here for an hour and they're back there for a half hour and it only happens half of the Sundays, now we're not talking about 26, we're talking about 13. Our Little Sprouts preschool, which Debbie Crawford is running, she does a phenomenal job. Dawn Green did a phenomenal job. It was the best preschool in the area. And we will continue to do that with excellence and impact the lives of young children and their families through our preschool program. And Judy Etter. I'm sorry, Judy. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your grace there. We will stand in the gap using our talents, resources, and finances. Everybody here has been given certain talents. Remember, 5, 3, 2, 1. This church needs those talents. You have resources. You can lend us equipment or do the whatever it is. This church needs to do those things. And I just want to say this about finances. Since I've been here for 14 and a half years, we have this law of undulation. We have times when we give and times when it drops precipitously. And then we give and it drops. There's so much more we can do if our giving were consistent. If people tithe and were consistent. And if you belong to this community, I think there's an obligation. There's so much more we can do. But when we go through a September like what we did, we spend the next few months trying to recover. And then we can't maneuver. So next Sunday, and maybe you won't come back, but next Sunday I'm going to talk about tithing. I'm just going to talk about it because tithing has everything in the world to do with Christian maturity. So I hope we're still friends afterwards. But you have to understand, I am 59. And I have a few years left. And I feel called to finish this race that God has set before me. And I feel called to re-embrace the leadership that God has called me to in terms of developing people and churches to do exactly that kind of a thing. And I'm going to do it. And I hope that you partner with me. And I have to push all those buttons in order to make it work. I just do. So I hope you understand my heart in that. So just in conclusion, I want to say this. And this is what I have to believe. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. You can do all things through him who strengthens you in whatever way he has called you. And let me just say this. If God is willing to strengthen us, then we are obligated to do what God is willing to strengthen us for. You see the correlation? I mean, if he's going to give it to us, then we got to do what he's going to give to us. So that's my heart. I hope you are tracking with me on that. I hope this is something that we can re-embrace together. I hope that you can understand this church has a unique opportunity to stand apart and to make the kind of difference in this world, in this community, that desperately needs to be done. I am in conversation with Christian organizations that have incredible opportunities to provide answers for this world that's desperately seeking for them, and they are so caught up in their little petty projects, they are utterly and completely blind to being able to help people who desperately need it. We can't do that. We cannot. And so that's going to be my work from here on.